And we were talking about the economic and social aspects of the United Nations.
Well, I was saying that the American view was that these were ancillary to, auxiliary to the peace and security funds.
Right.
Instruments for peace and security. That gives rise to an argument whether they're really subsidiary in the UN Charter or not. And I think that's a silly argument because the political history of the organization demonstrates that these have taken on meaning in their own right.
Yeah.
They have their strong advocates, and so peace and security no longer should be thought of, it seems to me, as the predominant function of the UN, that the others are parallel to it.
Right.
But that, I believe, represents a change from what the United States planned and expected.
Well, you know, you mentioned human rights, and the UN has contributed tremendously to the field of human rights and the advances of human rights. However, very little of that was provided for in the Charter, or
well,
was it discussed?
There's a paradox here. There's a paradox here because human rights is mentioned in the Charter, and particularly it's mentioned in Article 55 of the Charter.
Mm-hmm.
And that fact in itself has been a potent reason for the internationalization of human rights. I mean, human rights were thought of as matters of national concern, domestic jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm.
Article 2, paragraph 7 says nothing in the present charter shall authorize the UN to intervene in matters which are primarily domestic. Well, that was intended to protect sovereign states against having an international organization meddling with respect to their domestic affairs, particularly human rights.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, the words human rights were in the charter. And it became very hard thereafter to argue that human rights are domestic issues when they are enshrined in an international treaty of such authority and, and global impact as the UN Charter. So that's how that's how human rights got internationalized.
Mm-hmm.
And it started very early with Eleanor Roosevelt. And, you know, by 1948, it seemed a long time coming then. But look back on it, it happened very rapidly. By 1948, you had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Right, So that it was purposely put into the Charter, but the provisions for implementing it were left to...
The belief was there would be no implementation, and all you could do was discuss and consider and study and promote. Promote concepts, not protect. There's nothing in the Charter that authorizes the UN to intervene behind the walls of state sovereignty to protect people whose human rights are being abused by their government.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing in the Charter authorizes that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet that capacity has been growing too slowly, some would say, but still it has been developing in the 45 years since the conference. Another thing on the economic side, an anecdote, but this is more than an anecdote. Remember we talked about the bitter disputes over words.
Yes, right.
And
yes.
I noticed the first day I took minutes in the delegation that there was such a continuing argument going on, consuming a lot of time in the U.S. delegation every day, had been going on and continued, having to do with the words full employment in Article 55, what became Article 55 in the Charter. And the argument behind that is that in the United States, 1945 was a period when consideration was being given to the adoption of a Full Employment Act in the United States. And it had not yet occurred. This is an issue of intense domestic political argument between New Dealers on the one hand and Republicans on the other.
Sure.
And therefore, Senator Vandenberg, among others, was determined that the words full employment should not appear in the United Nations Charter because that would be a lever which might be used in the continuing domestic argument over social and economic policy in this country. And this argument went on for weeks and weeks with the American delegation instructing its representative, who, as I recall, was Dean Gildersleeve, that she must not agree to and she must obstruct the inclusion of the words full employment in the United Nations Charter. At the same time, in Britain, you were having the Beveridge Plan, this movement. Churchill was succeeded in the summer of 1945 by a Labour government. And we were out of step with the rest of the world because socialist concepts of the role of the government were taking over widely. And so, in the end, the word full employment words for employment were included in what has become Article 55, paragraph, subparagraph A, clause A, higher standards of living, full employment, and conditions of economic and social progress and development. But that took place only over the bitter end resistance of the United States, which favored softer language like fuller and higher levels of employment. But that, you know, it's an important anecdote, this one is, because it shows how the United States viewed the United Nations. It was determined that the United Nations should not be a serious actor in imposing economic standards on the world, even though the United States was the country which proposed that the Economic and Social Council be given status as an organ in the UN. I think the British had proposed that it be subordinate to the General Assembly, and it is subordinate to the General Assembly, but it is among the organs of the organization listed in Article 6 of the Charter. We did that. I guess we were ambivalent about it. We had the Rooseveltian Four Freedoms behind us, the belief that economic and social matters are important in the search for peace and order in the world, but a reluctance to to adopt principles which were divisive at home, and which Senator Vandenberg was in a position to resist. I remember him saying, and this was, I think, the first day I was in those meetings, and it struck me, and I've never forgotten it. He said, "Gosh, if the United Nations put the words full employment in this charter, my constituents back there in Michigan would say that I had sold out to Sidney Hillman." Sidney Hillman, of course, was the president of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in New York, Jewish. And so Senator Vandenberg got in his licks for conservative economics and anti-Semitism in one choicely turned sentence.
Well, we were talking about the writing of the charter. Who was it that actually wrote the preamble for the charter?
Who was the Librarian of Congress at the time? There was a great schlamazel over that. Field Marshal Smuts thought himself a brilliant man. And he had had a lick at the preamble. And it was, nobody liked it, at least in the American delegation. There was a great deal of dissatisfaction with it. And I'm sorry, I should be able to remember the name. Archibald MacLeish.
MacLeish, okay.
Was on the American delegation. Was a consultant to it, and he, and I guess Dean Gildersleeve had a hand in it. They were sent to try to make it better, and it's not really a great document.
But Smuts had written a first attempt or first draft,
well,
and then they.
I didn't say that because
I don't
remember at what stage he got into it.
But
it had his imprint on it, and he was defending it, and. We thought, the Americans thought it had to be made better, and he was being kind of stubborn about it, and MacLeish did make it somewhat better, I think.
And Virginia Gildersleeve, did she work on it
she
also?
She was the delegate in the committee who had to deal with
the writing of it.
But all right. There's a point that's worth making. The preamble has a tremendous awkwardness. You remember it starts talking the peoples of the United Nations. But then it segues to a final clause which emphasizes not the peoples but their government. And this was this was the awkwardness that this was a conference of sovereign states engaged in the creation of a treaty which would be the constitution of an organization of sovereign states. And so you did have a considerable tension between the notion of state sovereignty and the aspiration of many to make this somehow a more popular institution. And so they adopted that device of beginning with we the peoples of the United Nations are then joined on to have resolved to combine our efforts to accomplish these aims. Accordingly, our respective governments do hereby establish an international organization for the United Nations.
So the language there was purposeful, that there was an attempt to try to compromise between seeing the organization as a popular organization. And
but if you compare this with the Declaration of Independence, I think that on literary merit, Thomas Jefferson wins hands down.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple other issues that I want to cover with you. One is the enforcement of the Security Council decisions. Was it envisioned in San Francisco that there would be a military aspect to United Nations?
Sure.
So how was that envisioned?
Well, I think the charter is very clear that once you've got this decision in Article 39 by the Security Council that there is a threat to the peace, a breach of the peace, or an act of aggression, the sky's the limit. The Security Council thereafter has virtually unlimited powers to act through taking temporary measures to prevent things from getting worse, to impose sanctions such as the disruption of diplomatic communications, economic and transportation relationships, and then whatever kind of further measure involving the use of force that it sees fit to decide to impose. Now the limitation, the qualification of that, is that the military forces to be available to the UN Security Council for such purposes had to be provided in the form of special agreements to be negotiated on the initiative of the Security Council with member states which were to provide those special, which were to agree in those special agreements to provide forces and facilities and access to the United Nations for its enforcement measures.
Mm-hmm.
Now those special agreements under Article 43 of the Charter, they were on the agenda, and an effort was made to negotiate them in the early years of the UN, but nothing ever happened. No agreement was reached, and so no such agreement has ever occurred.
Okay.
Thus, the United Nations arsenal is empty.
Right. But it was conceived originally of that the UN would have a permanent force, but it would be made up of...
Absolutely, and there's another point which has contemporary relevance. When the United States ratified the Charter, the U.S. Congress adopted the United Nations Participation Act, a law of the United States to provide for U.S. representation in the UN and the expenses and so on.
Sure.
But there is in it a provision in which the Congress, in all deliberation and with the full knowledge of the constitutional provision that in this country it is the Congress that has the power to declare war, in that UN Participation Act, the Congress says that once a special agreement is in effect with congressional approval, committing U.S. forces to the Security Council, the President need not thereafter ask for the consent of the Congress to make those forces available for use by the UN Security Council. In the circumstances of 1990, if President Bush were to go to the Congress tomorrow, if the Security Council were to take the initiative to the United States and say, let's negotiate a special agreement to place as available to the UN Security Council the forces the United States has in the Gulf, and the President were then to go to the Congress and say, please approve a special agreement authorizing those forces to be made available to the UN, thereafter, under the existing law, the President would have the power to commit those forces to battle under the authority of the Security Council. That is the law of the United States as it stands today. And I go through all that. I don't seriously believe that scenario would work in November 1990. But I go through all that to emphasize the point that the United States and the Senate, in agreeing to ratification by a vote of 89-2, and the Congress, by approving the UN Participation Act, were very serious about a wish to have the United Nations security system as the primary resource of the United States in protecting its own national security. The UN security system was serious. It was regarded as the backbone of the organization. It was carefully considered by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The Joint Chiefs of Staff had to certify that these arrangements were indeed in the national security interest of the United States. And as a result of that, the people and the Senate overwhelmingly accepted this collective security regime as the primary instrument for the protection of the national security of the United States thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
It broke down because you didn't have the cooperation with the Russians that was
right.
necessary to make it work. But I have not the slightest shadow of doubt myself that in 1945 that was what the U.S. Congress and the President and the American people wanted.
Yeah. What about the Military Staff Committee? How did they envision originally that that would function?
Well, I don't think it had been too well thought through. The charter is quite clear that,
yeah.
that the, in exercising its enforcement functions, the Security Council is to be advised by the Military Staff Committee, which is under its authority. The Military Staff Committee is to consist of the chiefs of staff of the five permanent members of the Security Council or their representative.
Mm-hmm.
That it is to be the body to help plan UN strategy. It has certain functions of advice with respect to the UN's role and UN's control and so
mm-hmm.
on under the charter. And then the question of how it would work. A very strange provision in the charter says that this shall be left for the future. Which proves that they really hadn't gotten very far with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting, you know, that same UN Participation Act that I mentioned before, the United States legislation, getting us, authorizing us to participate, clearly accepted this Military Staff Committee arrangement when authorizing the President to commit American forces to battle under the Security Council. There is in that act no qualification of the charter arrangements under which the UN Military Staff Committee is to be responsible under the Security Council, I'm reading now from the charter, for the strategic direction of any armed forces placed at the disposal of the Security Council.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I haven't found that vague provision. There is here a provision putting off for future decision an important dimension of the Military Staff Committee's work, and I just can't find it at the moment.
Mm-hmm. But at any rate, it seems as though the concept really hadn't been thought through that carefully. So that the language isn't necessarily vague because of compromise, but vague because it was not really thought through.
Article 47, Clause 3, the Military Staff Committee, I've read that already, shall be responsible under mm-hmm. the Security Council for the strategic direction of any armed forces placed at the disposal of the Security Council. Questions relating to the command of such forces shall be worked out subsequently.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And there you have... I wasn't privy to those, and I've never looked into that provision.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense, if you think about it, in this way, that when you were writing the UN Charter, you could not really anticipate what the circumstances
mm-hmm.
would be
mm-hmm.
in which the Security Council might decide to use for
right.
and in which the strategic direction would be provided by the Military Staff Committee. Would you have forces provided equally by the Soviet Union, China, France, Britain, and the United States to deal with the threat to the peace in Latin America? Or if the issue was going to be in Africa, if it was going to involve Asia, if it was going to involve small powers or big powers, you would have very different needs for the forces depending on the circumstances to which the Security Council was going to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore it made sense to say that there's no way we can anticipate what the command arrangements for UN forces should be in these circumstances that may be very different.
Right.
And so what that says is you got to decide it case by case.
Okay.
And I don't think that's foolish.
No.
And I don't know how you could have done it any other way. Maybe that's a lack of imagination on my part. But and, you know, when in 1950 the UN Security Council did authorize the UN action, police action it was called, in Korea,
uh-huh.
The command of the forces was given to the United States because we had the predominant military force there.
Right.
And similarly, you might guess that if the UN Security Council were to authorize the use of force in the Iraq-Kuwait affair today, that because of the preponderance of the American forces there and because of the president's likely insistence that it be that way, that the authority, the command would be given to the American general under the UN. The UN would designate the American as the commander-in-chief.
Yeah.
Well, you can visualize another circumstance in which the, you know, the Brazilian general might be in charge, or the Russian, or the British, depending on the nature of the problem. I think that's what that
is. Was there any discussion about the UN having a naval capacity?
In the negotiations which did occur, yes.
Was it assumed that that would be a part of the...
Yeah, there is a provision in the charter putting special emphasis on air forces to be immediately available. Because the general belief that air forces were potent and that command of the air was an important condition. But nothing is excluded. And when the United States put in its proposals as to the kind of force the UN should try to have as a basis for reaching these special agreements to make the forces available, we had a very fully worked out military plan. So many divisions, so many naval aircraft carriers and destroyers and cruisers and so on, and so many air wing.
Yeah.
And the military staff committee met for years. Not really negotiating, but squabbling over these plans. And the American military took it very seriously. They disagreed over who should do how. Well, the Russians wanted more emphasis, less emphasis on sea forces in which we were stronger, and more emphasis on land forces in which they were stronger. And basically, it was all broke down because you didn't have underlying agreement.
Well, now, the other question I have for you is about the role of the Secretary General, because he was given a prominent role in the concept of the charter. What were some of the discussions about that, and was it considered important that he had a prominent role?
I hope I'm not wrong in saying this, but my impression is that not very much attention was given to those issues in the conference. That, in a sense, there had been a great power decision, and I think the United States led in this, that the head of the Secretariat should be should have a stronger legal base and be a more potent figure than the Secretary General of the League of Nations.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm.
And there was some dithering about what he should be called before they arrived at the name Secretary General. He is, under the charter, an organ of the UN, which gives him a certain independent base. And he has clear authority to administer the Secretariat and the affairs of the organization. But he is not intended to be a political leader of the organization, or at least he's not authorized to be. Except for the provisions having to do with his explicit authority to take initiative when he believes peace is threatened. That's what was thought to be an important power in the Charter, and that provision was carefully considered. Article 99.
Right.
The Secretary General may bring to the attention of the Security Council any matter which, in his opinion, may threaten the maintenance of international peace and security. That makes him, constitutionally, an important actor in the international system.
Right.
And later on, of course, Dag Hammarskjöld particularly used that as a basis for developing powers of initiative and autonomy, which he exercised very well, and which have been supported by all subsequent Secretaries General. But that provision itself has been rarely used. Secretaries General have been very reluctant to take the initiative authorized by that article in the face of disagreement among the other powers that they should do so.
Was he seen as a mediator in the sense that it has evolved into, or was it the position considered primarily administrative?
It was known that the position was considered primarily administrative. But it was known that the Secretary General of the League of Nations had sub Rosa quietly performed many mediatory roles. And I don't think it would have surprised any of the thoughtful people in San Francisco that that was likely to
be happen.
A role for the Secretary General. Mm-hmm. But, you know, his function as the commander-in-chief and the political prime minister of the United Nations in the conduct of the UN's peacekeeping, mm-hmm. peacekeeping function since the United Nations Emergency Force in 1956, none of that was anticipated in the Charter. Yeah. That's a consequence of the collapse of the consensus needed to make the Security Council work using the military staff committee system as was intended. My hunch is that if you do maintain the kind of great power agreement we've seen emerging since about 1987, that the Secretary General's role will necessarily diminish because the great powers, if they're going to be acting, are unlikely to want to entrust the guidance of the affair to anybody. I've written that, you know, with the great powers in the saddle, they're unlikely to entrust the reins to the groom. And it seems to me that we have to be prepared to see some diminution that's in this particular function of the Secretary General, which has been so important in the peacekeeping business.
Yeah.
On the other hand, that could prove contentious because for the group of 77, the smaller countries, they may be uneasy about a great power condominium. And if so, they may regard the Secretary General as their agent. And thus I foresee some possible friction over this issue in the months and years ahead.
Yeah. Or the important role for quiet diplomacy in the good offices.
Well, that's going to be desired. It's always going to be. And it you know, it's interesting. One of the things that has occurred is that as the UN has been riven between the Cold War camps and North and South and in other ways, the tradition has developed of regarding the Secretary General as the neutral embodiment of the UN, separated from the membership body. And that goes back particularly to Dag Hammarskjöld's mission to China to release the American airmen in 1958. Mm-hmm. He very carefully identified that mission as being in behalf of the organization on his own authority rather than in behalf of Security Council, which had been at war with China.
Interesting. Well,
that's not quite right.
We're a little getting short of time, and I wanted to ask you something about the membership. Was it considered that there would be universal membership in the United Nations?
Yeah, it
was.
I mean, universal. It's kind of a half-breed arrangement. Mm-hmm. Because the spirit and the principle of universality were undoubtedly dominant. On the other hand, the Charter contains a decision process for admitting members, which allows the Security Council to veto them. Mm-hmm. So there is that kind of misshaped approach to membership. But I think the concept of universality really was accepted. The problem was that you had some former enemy states, Germany, which had to prove that they deserved membership, but the expectation was that over time they would become members. And of course the big struggle was in the early years, and the ice jam was broken in 1956 with a political bargain which let in the applicants from both sides which had been prevented from entering. I don't believe that any membership application has been obstructed since then. I think since then any country that wants it gets it.
Well, we're really near the end, so I wanted to thank you very much. If you have some other comments you want to make, we might be able to fit it in quickly.
Well, no, it was a great, hopeful event. I guess the other thing that I should mention is the spirit of the time. This great war was nearing its end. Democracy was victorious against fascism. The great powers had collaborated in conducting the war, not far from perfectly, but reasonably well. It was a time of great hope. Caught up in it. I was an idealist and an optimist. And the city of San Francisco played its part. The hospitality was just extraordinary. The warmth of the reception. The hope, the people of the neighborhood invested in what we were doing. It was really inspirational.
And
I've never been involved in anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
I think,
and it probably contributed to being able to complete the charter and, resolve some issues.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
I wish I'd been in Paris the other day, because that may be the event that most resembles it in our experience in the past 50 years.
Right. Well, again, thank you very, very much.
Okay.